Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Jason Berry, whose political novel, The Last of the Red Hot Papas, is back in a new edition. It is a great pleasure to welcome Jason Berry back to The Reading Life. Jason's interests are many and varied, from the investigative reporting on the crisis in the Catholic Church, which resulted in Lead Us Not Into Temptation and Vows of Silence, written with Gerald Renner, a longtime contributor to the National Catholic Reporter, among other outlets. Jason published Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. He's also a keen observer and chronicler of New Orleans culture and has given us such classic books as Up from the Cradle of Jazz, the play Earl Long in Purgatory, and most recently City of a Million Dreams, A History of New Orleans at Year 300, the subject of his latest documentary film. Last of the Red Hot Papas, first published in 2006, reflects the author's view of Louisiana as a stage of the human comedy. It's his version of the spiritual comedy, indeed. Jason, welcome.
Susan, it is so nice to be with you. Thanks so much.
So glad to have The Last of the Red Hot Papas in this edition. Talk about stirring that pot.
You know, the novel came out originally in 2006. It was a beautiful edition by Chin Music Press of Seattle. But with so many books focused on Hurricane Katrina on the, anniversary or months thereafter, it kind of got swallowed. It's not really a Katrina book, although I had finished it before the storm. There is, however, an epic flood in the novel. It actually happens in Baton Rouge. You know, the book did pretty well, and there's actually a trailer for it. If you go to my website, jasonberryauthor.com, you can follow the links to the 8-minute trailer, which stars luminaries such as Jacques Morial and Rob Coig and Becky Allen, who does a wonderful role, a walk-on, as a sort of floozy, you might say. I just felt, after so many years, I really wanted to get it back out, and I wanted to get it in an edition that had a larger font size.
Thank you.
Well, writers deal with this as they get older, and I wanted to get a new cover because, I mean, the wonderful cover that Leslie Staub did for the original folds off and actually can become a poster. Mm-hmm. But with a paperback, it's a little bit tougher. And so I enlisted my daughter, Simonette, who is a professional artist, among other things. And so the corpulent alligator that is on the cover is her artistic contribution to the work. And it's sort of a symbol of Louisiana excess.
Well, that just makes it mean more to have it be a family affair like that.
There's no nepotism in this book, Susan.
No. So what was it like to go back and think about the time you were writing it? It's still perfectly relevant today as we are in this crazy election season.
It is a crazy time politically. You know, when I wrote this book, I wrote it over a period of several years in between the books that I did on the Catholic Church. And so, you know, I had this image at the very beginning of the work on the novel of the First Lady finding this licentious Cajun governor poisoned in the mansion. Who did it and why? Story of a cover-up. So in a sense, it allowed me, as the investigative reporter on those books about the Catholic Church, now as a novelist writing fiction, to sort of take artistic liberty and write about a cover-up from the inside. And I soon found that all of the key characters who were drawn into this story of intrigue and deception end up talking to God. They're all trying to figure out, why is this happening to me? And so it allowed me to have a lot of fun moving these people across a sort of chessboard of politics, love, and mayhem.
Well, you drop everything into the blender with politics as a base. You have race, religion, environmental issues, sexual politics, funeral customs, even a good bit of Louisiana music mentioned as well. It's as if fiction gave you a canvas to splash all the paint.
I take the fifth. Well, you know, I covered the legislature back in the early 80s. I covered several pieces of environmental legislation that failed. And in the course of that reporting, I spent a lot of time in Baton Rouge. And at times I felt like I was in a novel by Garcia Marquez, that this was like Latin America more than Baton Rouge, because the sort of surreal, outsized nature of what was going on was both funny and not. I mean, there was one piece of legislation where Ben Baggert, who at the time was a state senator, and of course he's not in the book by name, but one of the scenes sort of borrows from that legislation I covered. He was trying to pass a bill that would revoke tax-exempt status by industries who violate pollution laws. You know, you would have thought Chicken Little said the sky was falling. At this hearing, all of these guys were ganging up on him, these legislatures. What's going to happen to the Pack-a-Sacks in my district, one guy said. And Baggert answered, well, I don't think anything will happen to them. We're just talking about polluting industries. Well, here we are, 40 years later, and the pollution is even worse along Cancer Alley, the areas that are in the news. So in the novel, I decided to go inside the minds of some of these people and to see what they were thinking about the things they were doing. And the guy who is the kind of villain in the story is a man called Dr. Nobby. He's not a real doctor. He uses that name so he can get restaurant reservations. And he reminded me of a lot of these backroom operators I used to see at music concerts. The bottom feeders surrounding musicians were so much like the people I used to see on the fringes of these political campaigns, everybody hungering along the margins. And so, I changed all the names and everything. But these character types are quite similar. So I used the sort of environmental pollution as one of the narrative through lines as these people are trying to bury the governor with dignity and figure out who killed him. And why?
Or bury him on their own terms. I mean, to have a mortician in this book is brilliant.
Well, Reverend Christian Froh is really the moral center
of the novel.
And I was just delighted with Maurice Carlos Ruffin's introduction. I asked him to write it, and I said, look, you're becoming quite a renowned novelist, and I just appreciate your giving us your take on these characters. And I was just delighted when he said that Froh, perhaps the only character who answers to a power higher than himself, represents so many black politicians who've historically had to navigate a narrow path for the benefits of their community. Whereas some characters are clearly motivated by personal enrichment and others by decorum, it is Froh who allows us to think more deeply about questions of race, environmental justice, and political consequences. He gives a sermon about two-thirds of the way through the book. There's this very dramatic scene in the rotunda of the legislature where they're holding this wake for Governor Rex LaSalle. And the sermon in the novel is drawn from the notes I took, and actually I have a tape recording, of the sermon that Reverend Paul Morton gave when Raymond Miles, the gospel singer, died, and there was a huge funeral for him. And Morton based his sermon on one of the Psalms where the children of Israel are crossing the river and their harps are in the tree. Of course, they're in exile. They're trying to escape. And the point of his sermon was, we must go back and get our harps. We must let our songs of life rise and continue. He was honoring a gospel singer. And so I used some of the language. I dressed it up a bit, from that sermon. And Reverend Froh is trying to effect a piece of environmental legislation while he is burying the governor. So it serves as a nice kind of double entendre, I guess you'd say.
I always pay close attention when writers put sermons into novels because they really cut loose. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, sermons, yeah.
We're all frustrated sermonizers in a way.
Well, the novel, and I mean, Albert Murray once, in an interview I did with him many, many years ago, told me that many of the old New England sermons were sort of, you know, a kind of a template for what became literary fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the South, I mean, when you think about the, you know, the great works by, say, you know, Faulkner or Ralph Ellison or others, and the role of the sermonizer is always so important. And so I drew on that in the character of Christian Froh.
So what did you change? Did you change very much?
I mean, there are really no changes to the novel itself. I updated the, I guess what you'd call the preface. It's called Of Fact and Fiction. One of the things I did update was many people, you know, when the book came out, a lot of people saw affinities, shall we say, between Edwin Edwards and Rex LaSalle. And as I wrote in the first edition, had there never been an Edwin Edwards, there would have been a Rex LaSalle, some comic figure to embody the bizarre performance of democracy in these latitudes. And I made a point of saying in the new edition, in the you know, preface, so to speak, that Edwin was in prison when the book came out. So I sent him a copy. And he responded. He was sending out these sort of like newsletters to, you know, all of his supporters. Well, he sent me a Xerox of one of these things. And he wrote in the margin, "Thanks for the book, !" And then underneath it, "Interesting!" So he didn't venture an opinion.
Let us make a record for my Lord. Let us make a record for my Lord. Come on, let's make a record.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Berry, talking about his political novel, The Last of the Red Hot Papas. Now, you've often talked about your fiction as spiritual comedy. So talk a little bit about what that means to you, because you have such a rich spiritual underpinning to all of your work. I think of the books about funerals like Rejoice When You Die and City of a Million Dreams. You really have steadily nourish this part of your writing?
I have, and I think part of it stems from my childhood and how I was raised. I mean, I was as deep a Catholic as you could get. And when I started filming funerals back in the late 90s for what eventually became the documentary City of a Million Dreams, I was struck by the wakes in particular. You know, people talk about the second line and the parades for the dead, which, of course, are beautiful and dramatic public pageants. But I was also quite mesmerized by the wakes and the sermons and how, you know, each one of those events was almost like an urban short story. It was like a moment in time in the city. And the funerals, to me, were caravans of memory. And I guess there's an inherent sadness. I don't want to necessarily say tragedy. I mean, death is tragic. We all have to die at some point. But not every death is, I mean, when someone dies after a long life and is put away with great love and care, you can't really call it a tragic death. On the other hand, the drama and the profound emotions that I saw at many of these events really lodged in the memory bank. And I wrote about some of them in articles. I wrote about others in the Alan Toussaint funeral, for example, which is the opening scene in the New Orleans history. And in the novel, I knew I had to build the plot and the momentum to this sort of cathartic moment in the legislature when the governor is, you know, sort of put away, as it were. I mean, it's before the actual burial, but it's the wake. And, you know, people are at their best and worst at funerals. Many of us expect decorum suitable for the dead, to say that we respect the dead. And yet, oftentimes, when someone dies, people around him or her tend to be angry for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my father's gone. My mother died. And sometimes you see it manifested in wailing and sorrow. Other times you see siblings getting in arguments, sometimes about the will. I remember I interviewed I interviewed an undertaker for the novel because I wanted to know what it was like, you know, when you're burying someone. And he said, well, you'd be surprised how many times people argue right before the body is going into the coffin. I've seen people argue over a Confederate stick pin.
Whoa.
Who's going to get it? Well, you can bet I used that one in the book. It wasn't a Confederate stick pin, but we got it in there.
Yep.
So, you know, I wanted to explore what happens on many layers of a democracy in a state like this when the big man goes down unexpectedly.
Yeah. And right down to where the suit comes from,
yeah.
The funeral clothes, which is one of my favorite things in this book.
Yeah. At one point, Christian Froh's wife says to him, that's a $400 suit, Chris. Well, we'll charge the state $500 for it. You know?
I know. I love that. Now, you're such, you know, a Renaissance man of letters. You've written books of reportage, history, cultural history, drama, and you've made documentaries. Can you pick a form or a book that is your favorite?
I certainly enjoyed this novel, although it took a long time to finish because I had to keep putting it down. But it, as the characters grew within me, I really became so attached to them. I'd say it's a toss-up between this novel and the last book I did, City of a Million Dreams. There's so much in that history of New Orleans that I researched over many years. And in some respects, you know, the chapters, for example, on Sister Gertrude Morgan and Mother Catherine Seal are really quite dear to me because they show a certain triumph of the spirit in a city which eventually was torn to pieces, you know, in the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's exploring those narratives of rising after the fall that kind of sustained me.
And you've had a great response to the film.
Oh, the film has gotten tremendous reviews. Yeah. In fact, we're showing it at the end of July in Florence, Italy, at it's called African Diaspora Cinema. It's an international festival of diaspora-themed films. Unfortunately, we don't have budget to send anybody over there. But
darn.
Well, you can do a lot with, you know, Zoom interviews.
Yeah, but being there is really great. I mean,
It is.
Well,
indeed.
How has that worked with you? I mean, it seems to me that the work of a filmmaker and the work of a writer reinforce each other in really wonderful kind of ways.
Oh, I would say so. You know, I've done, well, I guess three feature-length documentaries, From the Cradle of Jazz,
mm-hmm.
which the book actually grew out of. That was back in 1980. And then when I finished the book Vows of Silence about the Vatican and the abuse crisis, I made a documentary of that one, which came out in 2008. But the documentary on jazz funerals, City of a Million Dreams, was just an epic. I mean, it took me almost 25 years off and on, partly because of Hurricane Katrina, which just upended the whole production. And also because, you know, I had to earn a living and all the Catholic Church stories kept rolling into my life. So I did actually three books during the years that I kept trying to kickstart the budget. And finally,
wow.
I got the financing to finish the film from a dear friend of mine, Bernard Biff Pettengill, who was we went to Jesuit High School together, and he came through in the clinch.
Well, all right. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm working on something that I'm a little reluctant to talk about because I haven't signed the contract yet, but let's just say it's a work about politics, and I'm getting pretty close to where I want to be on it.
Well, I was thinking the other day, you know, I interviewed Jim Burke recently.
Uh-huh.
And so I said, so what are you working on? And he said, well, he said, I got this Dave Robichaux book coming out next year called How to Call Boogie. And we both laughed wildly the way you laugh at a Louisiana thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And Last of the Red Hot Papas is that kind of title, too.
You know, I stole the title.
I know you did, but that's a Louisiana thing.
He called himself that. well, I'm hoping to get Earl Long back on stage. That is one project that I would like to do over the next year or so. And I've had a couple of people express interest. But, you know, Susan, I find myself fortunate at my age to be in good health and, you know, to still have outlets and to keep writing and publishers interested. I don't take anything for granted, but this city is so beguiling to me. As well as I know it and on so many levels, it is still in so many ways a mystery to me. And I suppose that makes it ever intriguing, ever attractive to a writer.
Man and his muse.
Many-sided muse at
Absolutely.
That.
I think, you know, how satisfying must it be for you to think, up from the cradle of jazz, I wrote that. You know what I mean?
Well,
people
I
are
did
still
it with John
reading
Cruz
that.
And Tad Jones.
Well, yes, but it's still still around.
Yeah, it is still around. And I'm sorry that neither of them is here to enjoy the long afterlife of that book we first brought out in 1986. But, you know, one of the things that fascinates me is the way New Orleans continues to reinvent itself. And right now, the presence of so many Cuban and Latin American musicians in this town, particularly musicians who have come here from Haiti, there is so much about their work that we don't really know a lot about unless you're going out to the clubs all the time. And I don't go nearly as often as I used to, sad to say.
Oh, say it ain't so.
Well, we try to keep the bedtime hours going, you know. But I think New Orleans, you know, my daughter, Simonette, is deeply involved in the crew of Chewbacca's, one of the downtown foot parades. And watching the people in that crew year after year creating those costumes, many of them are film set workers who will put in months of unpaid time creating these extraordinary structures that glow and dazzle as they move through the night. You know, this is part of the spirit of this town that absolutely will not bow down, as the Indians say.
Right. We're so lucky. We can say that in the midst of hurricane season.
Yes, holding our breath as
exactly.
we say.
Exactly, knocking on wood.
Yeah.
Oh, well, we've been talking with Jason Berry about the new edition of The Last of the Red Hot Papas. You can meet him Saturday, July 6th from 2 to 3:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Don't forget to check out the authors coming to town for Essence Fest. There are 3 full days of literary programming, July 5th through 7th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Montreal Convention Center, featuring authors as diverse as Roxane Gay, Ayanna Mathis, Nell Irvin Painter, Philip Williams, and many more. Check out essence.com for complete info. Jason Berry signs the last of the Red Hot Papas, Saturday, July 6th from 2 to 3:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for the guidelines for the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival and Saints and Sinners LGBTQ Literary Festival's Writing Contest for emerging writers. Tennessee Williams Festival hosts contests in one-act playwriting, short fiction, poetry, and very short fiction, while SAS hosts contests in short fiction and poetry. Submissions must be original work and not previously published. The exact dates for the festival coming up are March 26th through 30th, 2025. For Tennessee Williams, and March 28th through 30th, 2025, for SAS. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.